I came to this class as a seed, a potential waiting to be planted. Now, at the end of the semester, I am leaving with a piece of me that I have brought to life, something that I have awakened inside of me that will continue to grow. So said Holly, a woman incarcerated at Taycheedah Correctional Institution. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Studies make it clear that higher education can bring about transformation inside prisons. But how can mindfulness classes also play a role in healing incarcerated adults and preparing them for reentry? Joining me to explore promoting healing during and after incarceration are two guests. Dan Gruppe is a research professor at UW-Madison's Center for Healthy Minds who uses a community-engaged approach to investigating the benefits of contemplative practices for those impacted by the justice system, whether police officers or incarcerated adults. Chaplain Deborah Mehar is a formerly incarcerated community research partner at the Center for Healthy Minds who provides peer support to formerly and currently incarcerated adults throughout Wisconsin. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you, Emily.
I'm really looking forward to hearing about the work you're doing. It seems very important and groundbreaking, and also kind of your own stories, too, as to what brought you into this field. And maybe we'll start with you, Dan, because I see a list of many publications about mindfulness and approaching stress and trauma in prison or in the justice system. Can you talk a bit about your background and what led you to this field?
Sure. Well, I came to Madison in 2008 as a graduate student, and I haven't left since then. It's become our home. And I was studying at that time neuroscience, a lot of neuroscience research on anxiety and stress-related disorders, and had the opportunity to do some work with veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And we were doing neuroscience research and trying to understand what happens in the brain for these people who had been through combat and experienced a lot of trauma. But we also, as part of that research, were offering some mindfulness classes, some breath workshops, and really just saw the transformative impact from those people's experience that those kinds of practices were having in their lives. And it wasn't something that I had studied before that. I was brought onto the project for my experience in neuroscience, but that really stuck with me. It really made an impact. So I started a postdoctoral fellowship at the Center for Healthy Minds soon after that. And that work that I had working with veterans with trauma led to work with police officers in the Madison Police Department and other Dane County law enforcement agencies looking at the impact of mindfulness for the work that they do for their health, for stress-related conditions, and has grown and expanded since then in ways that I think we'll talk about to involve people who are touched by the criminal legal system in a wide variety of ways.
And for those who are not familiar with it, can you say something about the Center for Healthy Minds?
Yeah, I would love to. So the Center for Healthy Minds is a UW-Madison interdisciplinary research center. We have faculty from all different departments across campus, and our work is focused on understanding how can we use the scientific understanding of the mind and brain to promote healing and to reduce suffering. So we do that in a wide variety of ways. We conduct both basic research as well as applied intervention research in a wide variety of settings.
Right. And Deborah, I understand that you're connected with the Center for Healthy Minds too, but your path there is less traditional. Is that right?
For sure. For sure. That is correct. So I think I'd like you to know that, I'd like people to know that I never wanted to go back inside of prisons after I finished my sentence, was getting close to my sentence. I had a 20-year prison sentence. And I used to clerk for the chaplain. And so I would hear once in a while, I really tried to mind my own business there too, but I would hear her give news sometimes to someone and I would pay attention because that person would be come back to the housing unit then afterwards and maybe I could be helpful. But I heard her give the news to someone whose children had all were deceased from a fire and let me correct that. Her youngest got died in the fire. And I heard the way she told her. And so My voice was even rough then because I went to prison when I was in my 40s, and it was kind of rough. But I used to have a real soft voice, and my own soft voice came out and said, if I was ever a chaplain in a prison, I'd have a skill set to be able to deliver this news. And then I heard it, and I was like, oh, no, 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 never, never, never. You get me out of here, I'm never coming back. And there was no fighting it.
No fighting coming back once you had gotten out?
No fighting it. There was no, it was like a flow. It was fluid. It was just a flow. I ended up where I ended up working as a chaplain inside the prison for 18 years.
I'm guessing that because you were someone who was incarcerated yourself, that, and that's what continued to today, that when you are a chaplain working with incarcerated adults, or when you're involved in a project like this having to do with mindfulness, that you can speak from a perspective of lived experience and empathy and understanding, that makes a huge difference in how it's received.
Exactly. Exactly right. And also with staff, you know, at the prisons, the staff members would come to my office. Like my whole lunchtime was always with different people and being supportive of staff who I love and still have strong relationships, Department of Corrections staff. Mm-hmm. So it was maybe a little understanding more about who people like me are by being around me from staff, and then I could use my skill set to support staff and also the individuals that are incarcerated, sure. And so now it's like my breath. Right? I won't have as much of it if I don't do this work.
So it's a calling.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the problem with the justice system right now and why this work that you're both involved in is important. I think it was one of the papers that you sent a link to that I read where you talked about not really calling it the criminal justice system because there's a lot of injustice in the system. Can you, Dan, talk a little bit about the problem itself, sort of an overview of what we're facing here in Wisconsin, say, with people who are impacted by our legal system?
Yeah, I can provide my perspective, and then I think Deb can provide her perspective. And part of the power of the work that we do together is that we bring these very different lenses, and neither experience or perspective is more or less valid or more or less valuable, but can be really complementary. So from my perspective, the issues with the criminal legal system in Wisconsin and in the United States more generally is that justice is not really being served by this system. Justice is not being handed out fairly or equitably, depending on where you grow up, depending on the color of your skin, depending on your life circumstances. Your experiences of the system are going to be vastly different.
Probably income, too.
Income, all of these factors, the same actions that I would carry out as an 18-year-old white upper middle class kid growing up in an educated neighborhood, the exact same actions are going to land an 18-year-old young black man growing up in Milwaukee in prison, whereas I'm going to be forgiven, I'm going to get a slap on the wrist.
So maybe a little community service.
Maybe a little community service. Mm-hmm. So in the state of Wisconsin, we have racial disparities in incarceration that are larger than in any other state in the United States. You're 12 times more likely to be in prison if you're black in Wisconsin than if you're white. But the system is really not handing out, I think, what we could consider justice for anybody. It's a system that's grounded in punishment. It's a system that's grounded in retribution. And that's a system that historically has just been shown not to work. It's not resulting in justice for people who are impacted by crime. It's not resulting in people learning their lesson, quote unquote, or acting differently. What it's resulting is people getting stuck in cycles of harm and trauma that they experience and then they inflict on other people. So something needs to happen. Something needs to give because what we're doing right now is just not working.
And a high recidivism rate too, right? In terms of people going back into prison who are released.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And Deb, your perspective on justice system.
Well, my perspective is I've been doing a lot of restorative justice work and circles inside the prisons for about 18 years, maybe almost 20 years. And I just think of it pretty simply as the criminal justice system is, you know, who did it, who done it, who do we think we can get convicted, and for how long? Where, you know, restorative justice is victim, community, and offender coming together to heal the harm caused by crime. And also just, it's just so, when you said the financial part, you know, the economic, there's not any individuals serving sentences that have any money. Maybe in the federal, I would say, maybe, but.
But the ones that get off often can hire an expensive lawyer, and then they don't go to prison, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the sentencing laws, once someone's found guilty in Wisconsin, has a lot to do with where they're going to, like if they're going to get probation or get a sentence, has to do where they're going to go if the judge lets them go on probation. And in Madison, Dane County, if someone's going home over to Maple Bluff, it's a big difference than if they're being released to Ally Drive. They're not. They're going to be sent to prison because it's written in the sentencing about, you know, has a big deal about their support system. So,
well, and you know, let's talk a little bit too about what mindfulness is and isn't, because I think there's kind of a perception that mindfulness means taking deep breaths and calming yourself down, but some of the work you've done involves a whole curriculum, and you know, working whether it's with police officers or with incarcerated adults while they're in prison or after they're out. Tell me what mindfulness is and isn't, because I think, you know, we see it sort of now everywhere in little forms, including in schools, sometimes elementary schools, where it's to help calm children down.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, a song on Sesame Street or Daniel Tiger, where you take a deep breath and count to four.
Yeah.
So can we talk about mindfulness?
Can I go?
Yeah, please.
So inside the prisons, as part of chapel programming, because you have like eight religions Department of Corrections recognizes, but if you're willing to work and not need a lot of resources, you can do a lot of different things in prisons. So I had, one of them was mindfulness. So the volunteers came from outside, and we started mindfulness practices. And the big thing for me was this question I used to always ask, and I probably heard it from a volunteer. I don't think I made the question up, but I asked it over and over, you know, to encourage someone, kind of like for bait, to get them to join the class. And I'd say, if you could get 6 seconds back, would that change something in your life? And especially for someone who was in prison for a crime of passion or something where they weren't really living a criminal lifestyle. You know, that was definitely, they'd answer with a yes. And that's, for me, what mindfulness can do. So now someone gets the skill set for mindfulness, practices a little bit, and then they're on their housing unit and something happens. And if they can just, they pause and use that skill, I don't know how many breaths most people can take in 6 seconds or 10 seconds, but it's a few. And there is something about that. But when we're practicing mindfulness, for me, I'm a visual person. I used to think I was the only one like that, so I didn't tell anybody till way into adulthood when I found out, I think it's like a fourth or something, or a third of the population is the same way. But anyways, when I have mindfulness, I have like clouds, it seems like, my thoughts, and I'm just like, whoa, I have so many of them, and I'm trying to practice. And I'm like, you know, I'm busy, and I just move along, and I kind of make a move across like you would clouds, so that I can just have that peace. And I find that peace in some other things or some other happenings sometimes, but I know I find it there. And it's just peace.
So I think part of what Deb is talking about, I'll give kind of the academic.
Exactly.
Or technical, you know, more technical
clouds,
definition.
But then, to jargon or something.
But then weave those two together. I mean, at a basic level, mindfulness is about being aware of what is present right now in this moment. And it's about awareness that's not clouded with judgment, that's not clouded with wanting something to be different or pushing it away or pulling it toward you, but really this awareness and acceptance of what is here in the present moment. And I think so often we're so unaware of what's happening that we're swept up in our thoughts, that we're swept up in conflict with other people, that we're drawn into our phones, that we're distracted by devices or the outside world. And we can just kind of get stuck on autopilot without awareness of what's happening. And we have in mindfulness practices, you know, very intentional practices that we can utilize, that we can introduce to people. They're the most basic practices, but they're incredibly complex to master and to integrate into kind of your way of being. But I think with practice, that quality of awareness can have some of the benefits that Deb is talking about. You know, being able to see your thoughts just as thoughts, that this thought is not part of who I am, that this is not something that's permanent, but that this experience is one that will arise and will be here for a while and then it will pass. Or as Deb talked about, you know, those 6 seconds, once we have some self-awareness of what's going on inside of our bodies, we have more awareness of our emotional state, of thoughts, of what might be automatic reactions to something that activates us. Instead, we can notice that, we can take that breath, we can take a pause, and then we can choose a more skillful response.
I don't want to sound naive, but let's say you're teaching a police officer mindfulness. Might they not say, you know, while I'm taking this pause and this deep breath, I'm going to get shot? Like sometimes those 6 seconds, it's a life-death situation where you can respond either with too much force, and we all saw what happened in Minneapolis with George Floyd, you know, where you're not taking that pause, or you can hold back and become the victim yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, and when we were doing work with police, we started doing work with police in Madison in 2016 and really were actively involved in that research for about a 3 or 4 year period. We were really mindful or intentional about not being prescriptive with police officers in terms of this is when and where you ought to practice these skills. So we offered some of these practices in a classroom setting and then encouraged people to bring them into their lives in a way that was skillful for them based on their own expertise, based on their knowledge of different situations. So that might mean at first, these are practices that you're going to explore while you're at home. Is this body scan practice something that maybe can help you relax before bed? Or is this walking meditation practice something that can help you discharge some nervous energy? And is maybe a more skillful response than turning to drugs or alcohol. And then we encourage police officers, are there places in your work that are not those, you know, life or death, immediate action kinds of situations, but if you're sitting in your squad car and you're at a red light, can you take a couple of deep breaths in that moment just to ground yourself, to center yourself in between the last call that you went on that was really emotional and this next call that you're gonna go on that's an emotional, just so that you can build in a little bit more space. So it really is about introducing some of these skills or practices that can be implemented in a lot of different settings or scenarios, but allowing people to use their own experience to inform, this is the most practical or skillful way for me to use these.
And Deb, how do you see this as related to your work as a chaplain in terms of spirituality? I've noticed that some church services, for example, will have a moment of centering silence, which is kind of like a mini mindfulness thing, right? Where you kind of pull yourself into a different space than when you arrived and parked. But so you said you were working with 8 different religions in the prison system, and then this became an additional element that could cross boundaries between religions?
Between all of them. Because I think it's an ad for someone's focus. It magnifies their belief systems, their positive belief systems, instead of diminishes it. So, yeah. And we also had, Interfaith 101 or Religion 101, where I sat down in the chapel with three or four individuals from each of the participants from different, and volunteers from, so that we could, right, end some of the ignorance that we all have about other faith groups or religions, all that's in place that separates us. And mindfulness was always the beginning of each of those groups and the closing.
We're going to find out more about mindfulness and restorative justice in the prison system when we continue in a moment on University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Dan Gruppe and Deb Mehar, and we are talking about promoting healing during and after incarceration, particularly how mindfulness and other contemplative practices can be put to use in prison and after prison in exciting ways. How did the two of you come to work together on this project? And isn't it kind of unusual to have university researchers in sort of an academic area and then people from the community brought in?
It's unfortunately unusual, which as we've done more work together, we find ourselves asking all the time, why is this so unusual? Why would you want to do this kind of work in any other way?
Yeah.
We met through a mutual friend, colleague. Her name is Carmen Alonso. She's a mindfulness instructor. She's a clinical psychologist. She's a Taekwondo expert, master teacher. And I've worked with and known Carmen for years in the community. She was working on some of the work with veterans that I had done as a grad student and postdoc. Carmen has also been teaching mindfulness in prison settings for the better part of the last decade. Mm-hmm. She's a volunteer with a group called the Wisconsin Prison Mindfulness Initiative that has brought mindfulness practices to prisons across the state. And Carmen was also teaching a curriculum inside prisons at Fox Lake, Deb?
Mm-hmm.
And Deb can share
That's
that,
right.
But it was through Carmen that we came to know each other.
Well, Carmen showed up with someone that was a part of a group. She got permission to come in, much like when I met you, you came in with Jean Ferraca to Fox
For
Lake.
The uh-huh. Odyssey
yes.
program.
Mm-hmm. And Carmen came in with someone else. And then she said she did mindfulness, and she was looking for somewhere to do it inside the prison. And there wasn't a mindfulness prison initiative then, or in the early days of it. And I said, sure, I would love it here. And she was like, okay, well, let's talk and everything. And I said, well, let me get my calendar. And there was a calendar on the wall for chapel programming. And I said, looks like Monday... Right? Looks like every Monday morning's available. Do you want it? And she said yes, and that's the way it started.
This is what we call getting Mayhard. Carmen got Mayhard.
And then she had contacted me, this is years later. I was actually working at the Wisconsin Resource Center as a chaplain and then supervising, well, and working with the certified peer specialists that are serving a sentence, but they're serving as a peer inside the prison. They're licensed in Wisconsin. And she said, oh, do you know anybody that would be interested in, and she explained a little bit. It was a PCORI grant, right? Was it or something?
It was, so I had a grant with Mike Koenigs, who's a professor in the Department of Psychiatry. So we had some internal grant funding from UW-Madison to spend a year having conversations with men and women who had been incarcerated to understand from their perspective how could mindfulness or other sorts of practices or other sorts of programs have mental health benefits for people during incarceration. Mm-hmm. So as part of that 1 year pilot project, at the time we were working through Carmen's connections, we were working with the Nehemiah Center here in Madison. They were helping to organize this project. And we had a formerly incarcerated man who was working at the time with Nehemiah, and we're looking for a woman who could facilitate one of our women's groups.
And she said, do you know anybody? And I said, what about me?
Yeah.
And I really did not believe anything about research. I thought it was just some other way people made a living. They just went around being in other people's business. That's really what I thought
of it. Kind of exploiting.
That's what I used to think of it.
The population to publish and get tenure and all that stuff, rather than a partnership that's leading to some sort of good.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Deb, when you were serving the 6 years of your 20-year sentence, did you have access to anything like mindfulness or anything that, and how do you think your experience of those 6 years changed your approach to mindfulness?
Well, it was like, you could only attend whatever your religious preference was, and it was a document. So if you claimed Christianity or Protestant, really, because there was Catholic too, or one of the other ones, then you couldn't go to any of the other services, but you could visit some of the studies. So I used to go to Muslim, Wiccan Pagan, Buddhist, Native, to the studies. And I'm glad I did once I realized I couldn't fight being a chaplain because I had a little bit of knowledge. But so I knew what it was like to serve. You know, if they put me in a palace, I would have suffered to not be with my family. It would have been punishment. But it wasn't a palace, that's for sure. And it was like a dry desert. It was like, good thing I had imagination and I could take a drop of water and make a rainstorm out of it, right? But everybody didn't have that same imagination. And it was dry. And when I became a chaplain in the Department of Corrections, I knew that was why. Because everybody doesn't come up there for eight religious programs, right? Initiatives. And so I needed something else. I needed bait. And that's exactly what I used to call it. So to get people to come up there, what would it take? What would draw them? What would... Because you can't support people you don't have relationship with. You have to have relationship. So how do they come up there? How do they want to come up there? So I had a lot. I had so many initiatives. Forgiveness is a choice with Dr. Enright. Grief support, a diversity enhancement program, restorative justice. Morning, noon, and night, that chapel. And I was allowed because I did the work. And other people, of course, the people that lived there, they clerked in the chapel, they helped. We all grew together, that's for sure.
I've noticed that with a lot of studies, it'll be about something, but not involve the people who have experienced it. So it might be a whole big study on homelessness and what to do about it that doesn't involve talking to anyone who experienced it. And the same seems to be true with a lot of initiatives that have to do with prison education or prison reform or prison anything, is that sometimes formerly incarcerated folks are not at the table. Obviously, there's difficulty getting them at the table if it's out of prison, but just getting that information, planning programs that are what would be needed. It seems, Dan, from your work that you've been trying as you work on prison mindfulness ideas to hear the voices of those who can tell you something that you can't ever get access to if you just stay at the university.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the distaste that Deb expressed earlier around research, you know, when we started doing this work together, it's a valid thing to feel. That's a valid opinion to hold of university researchers who often have been pretty extractive of the communities that they're doing research on. And we have really been working to flip that script so that we're doing research with communities. Because what's the point in doing research that is supposed to benefit communities if nobody's at the table? I don't have those lived experiences that inform how can a mindfulness practice be most supportive for people during and after incarceration. I can provide my perspective, but it's just so incomplete. So we have, starting with that first project that Mike and I were working on together with Deb and Aaron Hicks and Nehemiah and Carmen Alonso and our other partners, starting with that work, we haven't done any work that doesn't include community partners in a really meaningful way. And it's not performative. It's not so that we can put somebody's name on a grant application because it reads well. We really are at the table together and setting the table together. Mm-hmm. And what's been incredible about developing the relationships that that I have with Deb and our other partners is that once we have a trusting relationship, Deb has incredible relationships with people throughout the community in Madison, throughout the state. And it really just opens up this opportunity space in a way that if we were just sitting within the university, we wouldn't have access to these amazing people and ideas and experiences.
Can you give me an example of something that you gathered from a community member, someone with a lived experience of incarceration, and how that changed the design of a study or, you know, added in something that you wouldn't have otherwise thought about? I mean, I know for me, for example, when I'm doing a program that is targeting poverty in the Madison area, just hearing from people about how difficult transportation is or the housing struggles or food insecurity or, you know, hearing the voices of people who are trying to make it to my class but can't because of these barriers has changed how we do the whole program. In your case, when you are bringing in people like Deb or Aaron or others, how has it kind of in a concrete way changed a study?
Yeah, I mean, from that very first work and the very first group that we held, in that first group we had about 8 or 10 formerly incarcerated men, and Aaron and Carmen were co-facilitating that group. You know, the first thing that happened was all of the questions that we had written that we thought were really great questions based on our read of the academic literature and all of our training as, you know, our PhDs and our degrees. You know, the questions that we brought to the table to ask these men about their experiences in prison, their experiences of mental health, you know, we crumpled those up and threw them in the wastebasket.
Why? Give me an example of a
because
question that
we
went...
Because we were... So, I mean, these questions were, you know... They were questions like, what kinds of barriers, you know, will we encounter to offering mindfulness practices inside of a prison? And it's a valid question to ask. And we can learn a lot more about that sort of question when we ask somebody who has shared lived experiences to write it. And also, I think with that first project, a lot of the questions we had were fairly specific, and the more specific your questions are, the more you're presuming you already know the answer to those questions. So the questions that we ended up asking in those meetings were much more open-ended, and it was a prompt that opened up a conversation that really allowed people to share their own experiences. And from those experiences, there's so much that we can learn. There's so much to be learned from hearing people's stories. But when we presume that we know the answers and ask very specific questions, we're never going to hear those stories. So that's still, I think, maybe kind of abstract. Concretely, something that happened in those first groups is that we knew we needed to provide food for people. And usually what we would do in a study like that is we might order takeout pizza and we'd have, you know, styrofoam plates. Deb's making faces over here. You know, and we'd set aside 15 minutes and kind of fit it in when we could in our schedule. And Deb said, no, 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 we're not doing that. Yeah. She said, we're going to have real plates. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a bouquet of flowers. We're going to set a round table where people can sit together. And we're going to share a meal together. We're going to break bread together. And that seems like something that might be peripheral to the research, but it's setting the stage. It's making people feel welcome. It's making people feel valued. It's making people feel held. And when we invite people into that kind of a space, it completely changes the tenor, the dynamics, the feel. And as a result, what we learn is so much richer because people feel seen, they feel valued, they feel heard, and they're ready to share something with us because we've shared with them that we believe that they have something valuable to offer.
Well, and it sounds to me as if then by doing it that way, you've recognized a common humanity, which seems especially important if you have incarcerated folks who were reduced in some ways to a number.
That's right.
Can you, you've been making faces, Deb, about when he's talking about the styrofoam plates and so on, but can you share sort of why that kind of atmosphere is important if you're trying to build a relationship that leads to actual answers?
Well, for one thing, the people I invited from community, the reason they came was because they want to change something. They want it to be better for individuals they left behind in the prisons or others in the community and heal themselves. So that's what brings people there. And it just shows how valuable, how we value someone coming by having a nice presentation to sit down, really good food, culturally different food each week. But to speak to what Dan was talking about us working with individuals with PhDs from the University of Wisconsin, you know, we kind of have them too. We have a book, and we suffered.
There's a great poem by Langston Hughes called PhD, where this boy turns into a man with a PhD, but there's this whole world he knows nothing about, you know, this vast world that is not in his books. Is that what you're talking about?
I am. Mm-hmm. But we had to suffer. We suffered. And we don't want anybody else to suffer, but we know it can't just be this academic stuff either to find the answers, to change something. And what there's so much that needs to be changed. I don't think things are broken. I think they're running exactly the way they were planned to, where people say this system's broken, this is broken. Oh, no. I think it's running exactly the way a bunch of men planned it at a meeting at a table a long time ago. That's what I believe. And I think together we can implement and have initiatives and change and heal. And, when I first started sitting with them, and Dr. Mike Koenigs is the other person, we started building relationship with ourselves, not just the work, but and that's a big difference in this collaboration as well. Like, like going to their homes. I remember the first time I went to Dan's home or Dr. Mike Koenigs' home or hung out with Mike or had Mike show my grandson the possibility that he could actually go to University of Wisconsin in the engineering and spend the whole day with him. You know, things like this. Dan offered to mentor one of my other grandsons. I mean, this is relationship building. It's not just, we just have a meeting once a week either. So, you know, and the more I felt valued, I believe, the more valuable I actually became.
Because you trusted the group enough to share things that you might otherwise not?
Oh, for sure.
And can you give me a specific example, either something that you added or that somebody else with a background of incarceration added to the planning of a study that then is going to actually translate into action in the prison? Something where if it had gone from the University of Wisconsin researchers with the PhDs and the articles directly into here's a program for this prison in Wisconsin, what might be different if that intervention hadn't happened?
Well, we practiced as well. Like we practice for mindfulness. We practiced with the individuals we'd have break bread with. We actually had practice and we had reflection and we had careful, their questions were just the same. You know, there wasn't any them or us after a while. So people came up with questions that we could ask maybe the next group of people to find out, dig a little deeper. What does this look like? And
I think from that very first project that we did together, our starting point, our assumption as researchers is that we are going to take an app. So our center, along with our affiliated nonprofit, Healthy Minds Innovations, has developed an app. It's totally free to use and download. It's called the Healthy Minds Program. And we had the idea that we were going to take this app and adapt it for use in prison settings where the practices could be delivered via tablets that are available to all people who are incarcerated in Wisconsin prisons. So that was our assumption going in. We're going to adapt an app. We're going to deliver it in prisons. And what we learned really quickly from those groups is that there's so much power in that group. There's a lot of power in people sitting around in a circle and practicing these practices that are very embodied practices, that there's a certain energy and exchange that happens in that group where it's not just that information is being delivered and somebody's passively receiving it, but people are sharing and learning from one another. And some of these practices that we can introduce set the stage for that learning to happen. So we learned, I think, through that very first study that there was so much power in that group and so much learning that was happening in every direction that if we just limited ourselves to thinking about an app that could be adapted and delivered to people who are sitting by themselves, maybe in their cell, that may still have some benefits, but that might be, I think that would be an impoverished version of what something like a mindfulness-based program has to offer.
Mm-hmm. Particularly for people who are struggling with isolation.
Who are struggling with isolation.
Really, you know, hungry for something that provides some sort of connection or warmth or hope.
Exactly. The isolation, the disconnection during incarceration and after incarceration when people come home and they have restrictions on where they can go, who they can spend time with. A lot of people shared with us when they come home, they don't want to leave their homes, that it doesn't necessarily feel safe, that they don't know where they would go. Mm-hmm. So to be able to provide people in the community after incarceration with a space where people can learn some practices, some techniques, some strategies that can support their mental health, that can support whatever goals they have for after incarceration, but can do that in a community, mm-hmm. in a group of people who have those same shared lived experiences where they don't need to explain themselves. They don't need to say anything because everybody in the room already knows.
Right.
More on mindfulness as a technique for healing during and after incarceration when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Dan Gruppe and Deb Mehar. We are talking about promoting healing during and after incarceration. Let's start with during. Deb, right now, what are you doing in the prison that you think is promoting healing? Because we know so many people who are behind bars right now are victims of abuse, of trauma, of really a lot of things, or mental health challenges. You know, that they're sitting behind bars with a lot of time, a lot of challenges and traumatic things there. What are you currently implementing in the prison system?
I've been facilitating book clubs with the certified peer specialists. So in Wisconsin, there are a couple hundred certified peer specialists who have been involved in the training, taken an exam with University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, just like all the other community certified peer specialists. And they serve 15 to 20 people each every week inside Wisconsin prisons. So I started with one book club, and now I have eight. But I just want to say the peer model, we know we don't have the answer for someone else. We know that the answer is inside the other person. So we support, reflect, help people, well, not actually help them, but just be present with them, to support them till they find the answer. And that's a big project of mine right now.
So helping those that are incarcerated tap into some strength, some resilience, some insight and awareness that they had inside and hadn't brought out to the surface?
Right, or that they've been oppressed and it's been buried inside them. You know, some of the strongest people I know, obviously, are inside of prisons. They're surviving there, or they did survive and they've been released from prison. And I'm not saying anything, I'm not leaving out the fact that there was victims, in my crimes and other individuals' crimes. I'm aware of that. But yeah, the peer model is, to me, is the perfect model. And that's what I see when we're sitting around these tables breaking bread with people from my community. There's no power differential. There's no clinician or social worker or somebody telling us this is what we need to do and this is how we need to do it. We get to explore and be curious about each other and about ourselves, and that's where we find answers.
In that reciprocal,
yes,
relationship of listening and,
yes,
sharing. So I know that You've been involved in restorative justice work, which is not the same as mindfulness, but it also helps promote healing as well for many different groups involved in the justice system. Can you talk a little bit about restorative justice?
So Deb invited me about 3 or 4 years ago to explore this program that's happening inside of Wisconsin State Prisons. The Reverend Jerry Hancock, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. about 20 years ago, started restorative justice programming through the Prison Ministry Project. These groups are taking place in men's and women's prisons across the state. I've had the chance now to volunteer at a few. One group with Deb and Jerry at Tichita Women's Correctional, and one group at Columbia Correctional. And in these groups, we bring together outside volunteers and facilitators with people who live inside the facilities to take part in this circle-based process where, as opposed to a more punitive justice system, we look at justice in this restorative way. And Deb talked about it before, I think, in terms of what was the harm that was done and what can we do to address that harm? Mm-hmm.
I've heard of some restorative justice circles and bringing people together where I'm just in awe that it can happen and work because it's sort of taking a risk. But I know if one person who's, I think her grandparents were both murdered, but, you know, helps with restorative justice and might meet the murderer and share her story, listen to that person, and if it works, it seems wonderful to bring about forgiveness and reconciliation and healing and moving on, but boy, that seems like asking a lot.
Yeah, those are special meetings, though, where a victim actually meets with their offender. Those conversations, that dialogue, is separate from what we do. When we
Okay, so restorative justice is not just bringing together the victims
they call them sometimes victim-offender dialogues in this one-on-one context. It mm-hmm. takes a lot of preparation on both parts before getting to that point. In these circles, we'll have about 15 or so incarcerated individuals in the circle and then these outside volunteers. And one of the things we learn very often in these circles is that this line that we often draw between a victim and an offender or somebody who causes harm and has experienced harm is completely artificial. That so many people who are incarcerated have experienced harm, have experienced trauma, and that's often at the root of what it is that they did that ended up getting them in prison. So unless we really look clearly at what is it that happened to you that resulted in this cascade of circumstances that landed you in prison, if we don't really address that at a deep level, people are going to be stuck in these cycles. So that's where I think restorative justice can provide a healing alternative to more punitive approaches to justice, where we really look at, you know, what are the underlying factors that resulted in you ending up in prison, and what do we need to do to address those, to interrupt that? So there's part of that process is this healing process for individuals, and then we do also bring in later on in the program for a 3-day intensive period victims of violent crimes who share their experiences mm-hmm. with the
like
people
in
the circle,
like a surrogate victim.
Oh, so it's listening to victims, not their own, but mm-hmm. just others,
right.
Just try to get that perspective and mm-hmm.
exactly.
understand how that person's life was torn apart.
And for the victim survivors, it's the offender is a surrogate for them, for their healing as well. And those stories, you know, I hear over and over. Mm-hmm. And so healing happens, power happens in that circle.
Mm-hmm. And then when we have people who are released from prison, it seems like in many cases it's set up for failure. They'll be released from prison often early in the morning when they haven't even had breakfast, no money, barred from a lot of employment, have to pay for parole, no housing perhaps, and very few services. And so not surprisingly, many of them end up back with the same selling drugs or back with the same kinds of offenses that landed them in prison to begin with. How is your work on mindfulness, for example, or any other healing approach targeting people who are facing reentry?
So you use the word released from prison, and mindfulness is a way of us being aware. It brings about awareness. So here's a little awareness. No one that's on supervision is released from prison. Department of Corrections cannot put people back in prison. They're not out. They're on parole, which happens to be the best prison Department of Corrections has.
So being out on parole, you call just a sort of different form of prison?
Well, the paperwork says, like for me, it said supervised at the John Burke Center, right, in Dodge County. Now I'm supervised. I was released to Columbia County. The paperwork doesn't even change. And I just don't think we've paid close enough attention, because two rule violations like a cell phone and being across the street from a bar revocates you. So you're not actually out. You're just at minimum placement. And I think that's what needs to change.
So when people are in that, as Deb put it, that minimum placement, Emily, you laid out all of these factors that are really set up working against people's success. And when you lay all those factors out, it raises a question for me, which is, what can mindfulness practices actually offer? Mm-hmm. And they can't change those structural conditions. That's work that we need to do to work upstream.
Yes.
To change things at a much more significant level. And for the time being, people are suffering a lot.
Yes.
And people need ways that they can find moments of calm, moments of refuge in the chaos of life after incarceration. They need practices that can allow them to engage in a more skillful way with friends and loved ones, that can find community. So these practices can offer mental health benefits. There's a lot of research that we've done at our center and other institutions showing the mental health benefits of a regular mindfulness practice. And they can also offer a way to develop these stronger social connections and social relationships. So those are some of the ways that when we develop this kind of program in partnership with community, people who have intimate lived knowledge of what all those barriers are that we're going to encounter when we try to introduce these practices, that's something that we can offer people in the short term for now, while we also work to change these much larger conditions that are setting people up for failure.
And if people want, go ahead.
So like I said, mindfulness has an awareness, and people just aren't aware. Mindfulness, we just become more aware.
And if we've been conditioned to be reactive, to react in a certain way to certain situations, or when there are certain cues or triggers in our environment that may lead us to act in a certain way, if we're operating outside of awareness, we have no control over our actions. And becoming more aware of those circumstances and how we might act in those circumstances is the first step to being able to choose a different, more skillful response.
Exactly.
I want to thank both of you for being my guests this hour. It's been wonderful hearing about your eye-opening work inside and out of the prison. I thank you for the work you're doing. I'm Emily Auerbach. My guests were Dan Gruppe and Deb Mehar, and this is University of the Air.